We'll call the Environment Natural Resources Policy and Finance Committee to order. Thank you for being here, everyone. Approval of the minutes. Representative Lewick, would you move the minutes, please?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Any additions or corrections, members? Hearing none, the minutes are approved. Before we start anything for the benefit of the group, yes, sir, Representative Hansen.
Just, Mr.
This is for the benefit of the group now.
Yeah, for the whole group. So I'm.
And we are on TV.
Oh. Better comb the hair, too. Okay. Just wondering on process. So, like a day like yesterday and today, where we have some testifiers, and maybe for the public, if they look on the calendar, it says overview, but it doesn't say who's testifying, or, you know, and it's hard, I think, like yesterday when we were in short time to say, is there anybody in the audience who wants to testify? And I don't know how to, you know, I think that's up to you as the chair, but how do we, if there was somebody who saw overview or wanted to testify and was in the audience, and I don't know if there was, how do we accommodate them, you know, or how do we do that if there's members of the public who may want, maybe sitting here and then want to testify, maybe lobbyists too. So just wondering, I think when we give the timeline for the day, how do we, usually at the end chairs will say, is there anybody else? But when we run out of time, how do we, I just want to make sure we're not losing somebody, you know, who might be there and wants to speak.
Sure, and thank you for that. It's a good point, and you know, I can tell you, and members, you probably know if there's some people here too that want to testify, and you know, it would be helpful to myself and staff if we get some sort of a heads up. You know, I will try to keep that in mind, obviously, so that we do get to that point. You know, yesterday we did move the calendar around so that people that travel down from Otter Tail County could get to the table, and then of course we moved MPCA to today, and then you know, we're moving the 404 review to I hope next week. I hope so. Yeah, I'm cognizant of that, and I certainly will make efforts to do that. And if people know of someone who's here to testify, try to get our attention somehow so that we can incorporate them into the process. Thank you. Yeah, and then, you know, too, then they can also just notify the pages and stuff, too, and the pages can get messages to us. They do a great job here, so thank you for that comment. Anything else? There's a couple of donuts from Paradise Cafe left up there, too, just so you know. Strathcona, Minnesota. 42 people. Okay, so here we go. MPCA, a little rulemaking overview, and we got Kirk and Greta, would you folks introduce yourselves for the record and who you represent, and proceed with your testimony. And I will say this, if there's anybody else here who is interested in making comments from the group about rulemaking, make sure you get your name to the page. Thank you. Proceed, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name's Greta Gauthier, and I'm the Legislative Director for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
Morning, Chair and Committee members. For the record, my name is Kirk Adelk. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And thank you for the opportunity here to talk about our rulemaking and how it fits into the agency's efforts.
Thank you.
To start with, real quick, rulemaking is a foundation of much of our work. We're very different than what you heard from the DNR. A lot of times, policy is set at a different level than the agency, whether it's the federal government, an EPA, or the state, and details need to be filled in. And I'll use two examples of it. One is with water quality standards. The Clean Water Act and EPA set the parameters for it and do require us triennially to review our standards work and look and see which need to be updated. So this forces us to go back and review our rules and also update them periodically. Another example is our tanks program. Our underground tanks program is driven by federal regulation, and when they make changes to their rules, all the states have a certain amount of time to make the corresponding changes, and that's, for instance, one of the rulemakings we're currently undertaking is updating our state rules to match the federal rules. As mentioned by DNR, the environment is a complex and dynamic situation, and things change over time, which again is why our rulemaking is frequent to make sure we keep up to that. There's a high interest in the environment. Extensive outreach is needed. This expands the time that rulemaking takes. Also, for example, our wild rice rulemaking, as you may know, there's been a lot of interest. We had an open house yesterday at the Dakota Lodge in West St. Paul, where we had a lot of folks attend. In our tiered aquatic life use, we have rulemaking. We have 44 different stakeholder groups, separate of individual citizens, that are partaking in that outreach before we move forward with the rule. As mentioned, unlike DNR, a lot of our rulemaking is driven to meet the needs of the federal government.
Mr. Kudelka, can I ask you a question? You know, just on the yes, I can ask you a question. Thank you. So, with regards to the wild rice, and you said that you had some sort of a meeting yesterday in West St. Paul. Did you say? Did you have a meeting up on the Iron Range,
Mr.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman, I have that information. Yes, we have two more meetings, public meetings scheduled. One is in Duluth and one is in Mountain Iron on the range.
Mr. Chair and committee members, yesterday House Research did a great job of explaining the different types of rulemaking. The next slide just talks about the three types of rulemaking the agency partakes in. And the most common one is the standard rulemaking. I know there was an estimate given of about 6 to 24 months for rulemaking, but in practice, it really does come out to be a 2 to 3 year endeavor because of the extensive amount of outreach that's done through the process and also the technical details that need to be worked through, and especially when we're responding to comments and technical information and scientific information coming back at the agency, time to digest that and make decisions. The second type is the expedited process. That is only if given by the legislature. In the last couple sessions, we have used that in a couple instances. It is for when we change a little bit more than terms, but we have the framework that is agreed to and passed through legislation. For instance, we did this for a continuous improvement on septic systems for building sewer connections, making that line up with the building code. The next example is the good cause exemption. And this, again, as mentioned by DNR, is when the change is made on a policy level, on statute, and rules also need to reflect those changes. The agency many times asks for that change. And so an example is a couple years ago, we changed a number of our permits from 5 to 10 years through state statute. We asked for the good cause rulemaking exemption to go through and then also make those same changes, changing 5 to 10 for our solid waste and other permits. And that's, again, a specific power given to us by the legislature to make that change.
But I will point out that when you said that we made that change, that was not something that MPCA wanted to do. I had several conversations with, at that time, Commissioner Austin and so forth. So it's just a point of clarification there. And maybe at the end they wanted to, but early on it did not go quite like that. But I appreciate you mentioning it.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the next is a copy of the rulemaking docket. I know on the handout has that listing. This is on our website. The front page talks a little bit about rulemaking for folks, and then an outline of the rules that we have currently underway, the rules that we finished in the previous year, and also those that we are anticipating to start in the near future to give folks an understanding of where the agency is heading. A quick summary of the rulemaking that was completed in 2006. This again shows the different types of rulemaking we did. The first three are the standard rulemaking process. The omnibus air rules is very technical in nature, where we collect a number of small changes that need to be made over time and bundle up into one housekeeping rule, like the omnibus policy bill is created at the legislature. Expedited rulemaking's two examples there from the last 2 years, and a third is the good cause exemption for a 10-year rulemaking permit. Next, we had a lot of discussion about rulemaking versus guidance, and that was something that was talked about yesterday. As mentioned before, rulemaking is binding and guidance is not. Guidance needs to flow from statute and rule, and authority needs to originate from there. It doesn't replace the rule. It oftentimes helps with clarity. A number of rules to be flexible are created with performance standards that need to be hit so that different types of situations can be handled, and we don't create a rigid rule that locks folks into certain types of procedures when they may not be open to them. This means that we can change as industrial practices change, as we understand an environment change, and it's often used to answer questions. And an example of this is our work with a foundry sands. In mid-August of 2015, they came in and asked for potential changes to allow for beneficial uses of certain types of foundry sand. Over 80,000 tons of foundry sand were being disposed of, and they were looking for other ways to use this in a beneficial use. They asked specifically for a rulemaking change. Our rules set out performance criteria, including the material must be characterized, it has to be a substitute for other types of like material, and doesn't adversely impact human health and the environment. This includes a process where folks would submit the information to the agency and decisions are made on a case-by-case. If we had written the rule with what we knew of potential ways to use waste in a beneficial way, it would have been a very narrow rule. And as technology changed and we found better ways to handle some of this, we would lock out those possibilities because the rule would not allow the flexibility. So what we did, we looked at the opportunity making rule change to put this specific change in there, but determined it would take nearly 2 years to do so. Instead, we worked with the groups, toured a number of facilities, talked with other states, and created an application and guidance document that included an appendix to allow for beneficial uses of multiple types of sand, identify the composition requirements that would be needed, and the potential uses. This still fits in the performance standards of rule. The authority emanates from rule and still allows that flexibility. What we've done is created a pre-approval system that's available to other folks. It also, guidance helps us share information. If we work with one partner and okay it, putting it in guidance now allows to make sure it's open to other individuals and not just that person to allow those benefits to accrue to others. As a result, within a year, we're able to have the application completed along with an appendix document that guides the industry on what can be done. It provides a level of certainty there that the rule itself would not. So as mentioned, we use guidance in a number of ways. First is the expedite decisions. We've talked a little bit about that on the foundry sands. We also use it in the chemical additive approvals for wastewater plants. A lot of times if one company or city comes in on a facility and asks for a certain chemical to be approved, and we can do research on that one, we can then give them the approval, and as I mentioned before, put it in guidance to allow everyone else to know so they don't have to go through that same process to show the homework on why that chemical that we've already approved in another situation is allowable in that area. Again, the authority flows from rule or statute, and we are adding clarity for folks and certainty. Second example is addressing unintended consequences and also responding to new technologies. This is a situation we ran into with the construction of solar arrays and our construction stormwater rules. A quick look at the rules, someone may say, well, the solar panels are flat and impervious surfaces, and as under the rule, they would have to do other requirements or may not be allowed to move forward in certain circumstances. But a closer examination of the new technology, one finds that the solar arrays have openings in them. There's cracks so that when they are able to tilt to move to meet the sun, those allow for water to flow through, and underneath is a poor surface, often grass or sand or dirt, so that this is not the same as a blacktop parking lot. And so through guidance, we were able to explain what type of information would be needed to make the calculations to show that, in fact, water was seeping through into the ground as we had wanted. Again, this is how we can make sure there aren't unintended consequences for quick readings of rules and to respond to new technologies.
And Mr. Chair, if I might add on that, on that permit he just talked about, or that issue around the solar arrays, that came to us after the industry got to contacted us. There's a big solar array going in down around Marshall, Minnesota, and then there's 14, I believe it is, solar arrays going in with different ones within an hour of the Twin Cities metro area. So it's kind of all of a sudden we had this big new activity going on, and our rules didn't fit it. So what, that's when a guidance comes in handy, because it doesn't take us as much time as a rule. We can turn it around faster and help a new industry like that that wants to go and wants to move now and has people ready to do the work.
So we talked a little bit about the benefit of guidance to outside parties. The clarity, the predictability, and understanding of what the rules mean. The second situation is also it helps document for internal uses the consistency and available to everyone. This is another benefit not only to outside parties, but to the agency to know that situations will be handled the same when there are that performance standards that need to be met. I know there's been discussion of concerns of about guidance going too far, and we agree that there are, there needs to be a process for this, and there is in the 2001 law. The ALJ and the courts can decide when agencies have overstepped their bounds and guidance does not match the authority given to them in rulemaking and that. And we believe that's an effective solution to deal with the situation. But even before that, if folks bring to us individual pieces of guidance that they believe may go too far, it's a time for us to talk through that and determine if the agency had made a mistake or not. And we believe that's a way to quickly resolve these types of situations. So with that, Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for the time, and I'm available for any questions.
Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Couple quick questions. One, we heard the word performance-based standards come up repeatedly. How far, how well are you able to incorporate that? That gets you out of the, oh, something new showed up here, and we don't have a rule that sets a specific standard. Rather, the person on the ground that's looking at from the permitting perspective looks and says, gosh, water goes through that, doesn't run off it, it meets a certain standard based on observation and performance. I mean, how far have we moved in that direction? I can tell you at the county level, at least where I come from, our ordinances go there first because technology changes literally day by day, and paper and ink doesn't.
Mr. Gadelka. Mr. Chair and committee members, it's a mix. You're correct. A number of rules do have the definitive yes-no type statements in there. But there are other opportunities where we do try to build flexibility in for those performance standards. It really does depend on the situation and if there are a lot of variables that need to be considered, and if the rulemaking at that time can handle that, or if there are conditions that we can lay out to be met, those performance criteria, as you mentioned, that your county uses. So it is a mix.
A follow-up on a little broader question. I was doing a little looking back and on the general Class 3 and Class 4 standards. I was looking at notes and correspondence from 2010 and earlier that there was a need to reexamine both of those significant set of rules. It's 2017. I see it's listed here that we may or may not complete that process in 2017. That's 7 years later, at least. So that doesn't quite square with the 3 to 4 years. It's almost double what your own assessment is on the length of time it takes to change the rule. And obviously, if you go back and look at a perfect world and look at the standard timeline for even a standard rule, we should be working on a 24 months plus maybe a little bit schedule. What can we do to fix that? And then where are we at on the 3 and 4 class standards? That overall review. I know the sulfide standard complicates that.
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I can help with a high-level piece there, but the specificity on the rule, I'll need to ask for some help on that. Overall, our rulemakings do take an amount of time, and I think it really, you can count when the rulemaking starts, when you do the rest, first request for comments, and then to the end. But there's a lot of work even before we get to that part that is, takes place. We can be starting talking with interest groups to determine how they would like to see the rule move on. We can be doing research in that. And sometimes what we'll do is we'll do that request for comment, put the flag in the ground saying we are going to do this rulemaking. We ask folks to give us information on how they would like it to proceed and collect that information and then go through deliberations and determine what the language should be. Often going through that, we find, you know what, how this ends up is different than how we started and how we were looking at this at the beginning we put in our request for comment. As a result, we have to put out another request for comment and start that process over. And it's not unusual for us to open up a couple opportunities for public comment early on. So it does lengthen. And a lot of times that does happen in our standards work, our science and tech information as we continue to dive into an issue or something an outside party brings to us, takes more time. 2 to 3 years, you're correct, is more for a less technical or one with less public interest rulemaking, but our standards works do take sometimes 5, 6, 7 years. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague to talk specifically about the 3 and 4.
Just a minute, Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Just a quick comment on that. Understand, you've explained what the status quo is. Investors, bankers, business people don't have that luxury to go 2, 3, 4, 5 years on a capital investment. They have to work at the speed of technology and change, and we have just got to strap up our boots here and straighten that out, because we lose opportunity throughout Minnesota on a whole bunch of things, because there's other places that can move faster and still protect the environment. And so I'm just saying it's broken. And we've got to get that timeline down, because the rest of the world is moving at 5 times, 10 times faster. But anyway, that's, again, understand, you repeated what we already know. We got to fix that. But I'm interested in the more detailed element of Class 3, Class 4 standards.
Proceed. State your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Shannon Lothammer. I'm the Director of the Environmental Analysis and Outcomes Division at the Pollution Control Agency. That's the group that does both water quality and air quality monitoring and also our standards development for water quality. With respect to the Class 3 and 4 standards, which are the standards that cover industrial and agricultural uses, a big part of the reason why it's taken and the amount of time that it has to move forward on this particular rulemaking is that in addition to kind of getting the scientific information that's needed to justify a change in a water quality standard, we also need to bring stakeholders along, most notably in this case the Environmental Protection Agency, because ultimately they have the authority to approve or disapprove any changes to our water quality standards. So we've had a lot of back and forth discussions with both local stakeholders in Minnesota and then also with the Environmental Protection Agency to work through issues and concerns about the Class 3 and 4 standards. That does lengthen the timeline because, you know, we work through those issues heading into then the formal public notice and comment process.
Follow-up, Representative Lewick.
Thank you for that explanation, and unfortunately that's the status quo. When we're talking 7 years plus, maybe the agency can continue to work at that pace, but our industries here in Minnesota can't. So, frankly, a lot of them go elsewhere, and that costs us. I'm interested in how we can look around and see how other states, other countries, they don't even have this issue in Canada right next door to us, at least to the extent that we do here. We need to go back, look at what we're doing, and figure out a more efficient way to do this. The
the time issues are just beyond belief here. We're doubling what we admit is a general standard to follow. That seems to the standards, and I, you know, yes, we know EPA has got a big foot, and we're delegated. We do things on behalf of EPA, but so does the other 50 states. Not all of them are delegated. You know, if we can't fix that, then we've got to start looking at other alternatives. That timeline, because it's preventing economic development that could actually take place. Without harm in the environment. So again, I just we really need to focus on that as a, you know, we get it. It takes twice as long as it should at best. How do we fix it? And again, that'll be a long conversation we're going to have over the next 2 years.
Thank you, Representative Lewick. And to that point, before session started, I had meetings with MPCA. And ask them to bring some suggestions forward to do some reforms, to speed things up and so forth. It's going to be interesting to see what comes forward. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for the testimony today. Yesterday I asked some questions of Mr. Gehring about the use of peer-reviewed science and the cost of rulemaking to implement the rule. And I asked those questions because I hear frequently about those being problems. And I've been waiting to hear what the MPCA has to say about that. I'd like to hear your comments about both how you use peer-reviewed science in your rulemaking processes, and then how you express, or what do you do to express the cost of that rulemaking. In the case yesterday, we're talking about in large cities larger than five that have more than 10 employees. So,
Commissioner Kudelka, or Ms. Gauthier.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'll just start quickly with the peer-reviewed science. I think there's a difference on what part of the process is peer-reviewed. The information that we get in, the science that we rely on, does have a peer-reviewed process, including being published in reputable journals, and that information comes in. That peer review is done before the agency starts moving forward. So that process is there. If there's new science or information that the agency is the one that create, there oftentimes our scientists do also go through the peer review process as we publish in various journals. And so I think it depends on what is that source of science that the agency is using, if it had been peer reviewed already, or if it is new science that the agency has done and has it gone through the peer review process. And with that, I'm going to turn over my colleague to talk about the cost-benefit piece.
Sure. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a follow-up on that?
Yes, Representative Clark, go ahead.
You mentioned that the peer review science, that's really done prior to the rulemaking process. Is that documented in the rulemaking process? Do you do a literature review as part of the rulemaking? Is the public able to ascertain the depth to which you've gone into the peer reviewed science on it?
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the SONAR, the Statement for Need and Reasonableness, outlines that. We also have a number of times technical documents that are created much before we do the SONAR that outlines the source of our science. And with the discussion of the SONAR, I'm going to turn over to my colleague, Greg Gauthier, to talk about cost-benefit and how that's incorporated in the SONAR.
Ms. Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Johnson members. So the Statement of Need and Reasonableness, or what people call the SONAR, was created by the legislature in 1984. It's in Chapter 14, Section 131. And in 2012, the legislature, when it was created, it required the agencies to look at economic and cost issues related to the new rule that's being proposed. The Statement of Need and Reasonableness statute was changed by the legislature in 2012. It was expanded on the cost. So just very briefly, the agency working on the rule has to describe the different people that would probably be affected and how they would bear the cost amongst them, the cost to the agency and to any other state agency of doing the rule, whether there are less costly methods of achieving the same goal besides the rule and what those are and why they were not chosen, describing all these alternatives that we could use, again, and why they were not chosen, the cost that it will be for people to comply with the proposed rule, So that has to include the costs that will be borne by different parties that would be impacted, like separate state and local government or different types of industry or businesses or individuals. So those costs all have to be laid out in the SONAR. The probable costs of the consequences of not adopting the rule. So if we don't do this rule, what will the cost be to different groups and industries and society and so forth? The difference between the proposed rule and existing federal rules and analysis of the need and reasonableness and economic impact of both of those. And then we also have to do the cumulative effect of the rule with all other federal and state regulations, and that has to include cost as well. So a lot of that was put in, and that is a pretty, if you ask me, broad analysis of the cost, and the legislature put that together between over the years from 1984, most recently amending it in 2012. As an example, another water rule that we did recently, we finished it in November. It's called, it's got a funky name, one of those EPA names. It's called the anti-degradation rule. I don't know why, where they come up with those, but anyway, the SONAR, or the Statement of Need and Reasonableness that has all these costs in it, the SONAR for that rule was 188 pages long. And then it had hundreds of pages of attachments, exhibits, addendums to go with it. So we take this very seriously, and a lot of this cost information is kind of new, these requirements. So this anti-degradation water rule that we did in November was one of the first big rules that we went through this whole new process. So it was 188 pages. I was going to make a copy, but I figured I could send you folks a link to it instead. So I just wanted to give that as an example of how we do a very thorough job of looking at cost, and we have been doing that since 1984 in one way or another, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. You know, when I take a look at and listen to the SONAR, the Statement of Need and Reasonableness, and get a little editorial here, I would say that reasonableness is something that a lot of people are really scratching their head about, and Representative Lewick alludes to it. So much of what we're doing, and as Representative Lewick points out, it's just so painfully slow, and the reality is that businesses are making decisions to locate other places as a result of permitting, partly. Cities and counties are struggling with permitting processes. And we had Mr. Hanen here yesterday from Otter Tail County talking about what's going on with demo landfills and how the permits are not being reissued. Granted, they can continue to operate. But, you know, their perception is that the guidance document is being used as a condition for reissuing of a permit. And that's not what a guidance document is for. And we need to figure out a way to address these issues within the guardrails of what you have in place. The demo landfill situation in rural Minnesota is an extremely important issue. And I honestly believe that if the agency continues to drag their feet on this and they continue to put requirements for whatever they want to do that's going to increase costs exponentially, a lot of those demo landfills are going to close. And we've had this discussion before. Much of that demo landfill material is going to wind up someplace else where we don't want it. And the agency needs to figure out a way to expedite this process and get this moving along. And to use the guidance document, as a basis for the issuing of a permit, that's not the way the system is set up. And you need to use the statutes and the rules to do that. And Representative Lewick talked about certainty and so forth. That's what we're looking for, is some certainty in these things. So, and with regards to the scientific information that you talked about, Representative Johnson, I think that there is some skepticism about the scientific information that is being presented at times. And maybe it's just a sign of the times, I don't know. But when I hear from constituents and other members that permitting is going very slow, and you have a large industrial facility that's looking to get a permit, and they find out that it's going to take a couple of years, but then, oh, by the way, if you make a rain garden or plant some pollinator-friendly materials, we can speed your processes up and get your permit to you quicker. Can you tell me today that that is not going on in the agency, but where you're kind of trading or bartering for permits? Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we prioritize our permits based on those that need allowances to continue forward, whether that's a new construction, a permission, or documents needed to help with loans and that type of information. That's how we prioritize our permits. That does mean we do have, in some cases, a backlog of permits that are just need to be renewed. The application material's in, so they've met the federal requirements to continue to provide them the liability protection that they seek. And so there is that cost change. The question of whether or not something's done because of pollinator-friendly items, the agency doesn't have a permit for pollinator-friendly permits. So I think if there are other examples we can look at that. But overall, that is our policy of construction, those type of things that allow for new activities to go first before renewals that can continue to operate.
Members, we need to move this along here as quickly as we can. I'd like to get this done and we do have a list. I'd like to get this done in the next 5 or 10 minutes because we do have Bowser on deck. Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to follow up the line of questioning that my good friend Representative Clark Johnson had. You know, when you talk about and answer this question about peer review process, I was given to understand that your scientists, of course, consult scientific journals and other publications, papers, things like that before you write a rule or promulgate a rule. But is there any opportunity in the process for true peer review process where outside scientific information that may be available through other outside experts that disagree with your scientific analysis, is there any part in the process where that happens, where you get true peer review boards where they sit down and talk and discuss an opposing scientific viewpoint?
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the request for comment process asks for all available information folks would like us to consider before starting the rulemaking process. That's an opportunity for folks to share information. I know the wild rice rulemaking right now, the chamber has done some of its own sponsored research from scientists that they have shared with us, and that's something that we're incorporating in the process. The response to when we put out a draft piece of language for folks to review, they can comment there, and a lot of folks then provide why they believe the agency maybe made a decision that they may not agree with, and they provide additional scientific backing sometimes for their point of view. That then goes through the process. We examine that in both of those situations, and then also then the administrative law judge has an opportunity to weigh in on that too as you go through for a hearing and other types of comments.
President, you going to follow up?
I think.
Ms. Gaffier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I may say one quick thing, and that points to a reason why it takes government longer to do things than business sometimes, is because government has checks and balances. So we have the judicial branch involved in, like Kirk Commissioner just said, in the rulemaking process. The legislature is involved in the rulemaking process. The stakeholders are involved in the rulemaking process, et cetera, et cetera. Businesses don't have checks and balances. We do.
In the interest of time.
I was going to say, would you like to respond to that, Representative Uglum?
Never mind.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you. I'll try to make this very brief, Mr. Chair. This is just a question about terminology. I can't help but notice the term anti-degradation, and I'm trying to figure out if it's a double negative or double speak.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, go ahead. Ms. Gauthier.
I'm pretty sure, Mr. Chairman, that's an EPA. It used to be non-degradation, and so somehow anti, yeah.
Ms. Lonhammer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson, I can't speak to exactly where that came from, but it is an because it originated with EPA, it comes from the Clean Water Act and federal regulations. The concept is to avoid degrading high water quality as much as possible. So in Minnesota, we had used the term non-degradation, and that confused everybody because it was different than the federal term, so we just switched to the federal term. I hate that term, too. I wish that it was something different, but that's kind of where it came from.
Just a quick follow-up. You know, we wonder why people have trouble understanding the work that we do and why we do it. Nope. And then we create these terms and we use these acronyms that make it impossible for people on the surface to realize what stuff is about.
Yeah.
We need to stop doing this.
Thank you. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, my questions have kind of evolved as we have been talking, but my first question was going to be, as you come back and talk with us about any ways that you might suggest making the rules more efficient, I would ask you to attach a price tag to that so that we know to what degree the issues are issues of resources for the agency. So if there are recommendations, I want you to make sure, please, that you would attach if it requires more people to speed up the time, let's talk about what that costs, that sort of thing. The other question, though, that kind of came up during this discussion, and Mr. Chairman, when you talk about the difference between the time it might take to do a pollinator-related issue versus an industrial-related issue, one of the things this agency has to do is look at health consequences. When we were, and that's not the job of business to do that necessarily. They may do some of it, and they might ask for help and have some of their own expertise. But we ask this agency and the SONAR to give us, you know, a whole realm of information about what are the external costs, what are the extra costs, what are the long-term costs. So, for example, I'm just looking at the generation of toxic chemicals. It's not declining. It's going up. And the reporting is going down. So, I mean, we've had to get some increase in reporting, but, you know, we need to have better. So, for example, the terrible thing that happened in Flint, Michigan with lead, you know, the cost of cleaning that up. And I have to tell you, it's something that we have right here in Minnesota, all our old homes, our old infrastructure in our cities and towns. We're putting lead into our bodies, into the bodies of brand-new little babies and pregnant women and children and elder people who we now know that lead has something more to do with Alzheimer's and some of the increases. At least it's a scientific question that we think. So the long-term consequences, and I appreciated when you talked about the stakeholders. So I want to make sure that we're not compromising that work that you are required to do to look at the other consequences, the external consequences of some of the issues that we asked you to look at. And I think, although you didn't say it, I think part of the work with the SONAR has to do with coordinating with agencies like the Department of Health, correct? The Minnesota sources plus some of the federal sources. And that science is evolving. It's been neglected, but it's evolving. So I just wonder if you would say a little bit more about that and how we need you to continue to make those kinds of approach to those costs. Because the long-term costs, for example, we're just talking about lead, of kids who are lead poisoned or of pregnant moms who are exposed to something that then results in a birth defect, those long-term consequences cost money to our society, and I assume that that is some of what you're talking about when we allow some of that kind of toxic exposure out there that you have to be looking out for.
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we thank you for those comments. We do work with other agencies, Department of Health, specifically when we're working on health standards, and so that is important into the issue. The cost in terms of health and other societal issues is harder to quantify than the cost of a piece of treatment equipment. So it is something that takes the agency longer and sometimes is not as well defined as a result, but it is something we're trying to make improvements on and to quantify that in terms of dollars and cents. Sometimes it's more narrative.
Excuse me, Mr.
Representative Clark.
What do you mean it's more narrative?
Mr. Chair and committee members, yep. More description of the potential impacts where it's hard to define what a case of asthma may mean to someone. It's a little harder to put that in dollar and cents because there's more than just dollar and cents, doctor bills, and that the RRB impacts.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I know it's harder, but I think it is part of what we asked you to help put into that SONAR, correct? And can I trust that you're doing it?
Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, it is something we do work to put on in there, but it is something that is a little harder than when we look at the cost of how much it costs to buy a piece of equipment. So it does take us more time.
Right. Right. Mr. Chairman, just one final comment.
Yep.
I know it's harder, but, you know, we just had a air alert here in the cities, you know, and we had kids who were missing school, people who were missing work because they couldn't go outside. You know, there is a cost to that, and I just want to make sure that we don't forget about that when we're talking about what, you know, what we're asking people to look at. That's all. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I think it's really important to keep in mind the word evidence. Evidence is important rather than anecdote, rather than stories that may be a one-item issue. And I think we see a trend at the legislature where storytelling versus evidence is used. And the catch-22, I think, in this whole discussion is that if you want to have peer review and you want to have public involvement and you want the interest groups to weigh in, that's going to take more time. So shorter time, no peer review, no public meetings, no time for business to weigh in. So the agency has to balance that. And all these bright people that are in the room here have the opportunity to weigh in. The task for the agency is to look at all Minnesotans who can't be here, the poor and the dispossessed who are drinking this water and breathing the air and don't have the resources to be here or to engage in peer review or public meetings or business input. So I know the gasps that came with Ms. Gauthier saying there's no check and balance on business. There is one. And that is people don't have to buy your stuff.
Marketplace.
The marketplace. So if you're a polluter and you're wrecking the water and you're wrecking the air, it's not their fault. People don't have to buy your stuff. And they won't. So there's a business benefit for being for actually cleaning up the air, cleaning up the water. And what these folks are trying to do is provide some guidance after budget cuts, years of budget cuts, Representative Park. Years of budget cuts. It takes people to process these items. We are a growing state. And so there's more people, more business, more challenges. So if we want things to speed up, and I want the public involved, all the public to be able to be involved, and for the agencies to think of the public, not just the people who have the time or the resources to be able to meet them or call them up or make them jump. I want them to be there for the public. And that's going to take time. So if we want that time to be reduced, then we better provide for more people.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep.
I think this providing more people is going to become one of the theme songs here. What I'm hearing is kind of a split conversation, Mr. Chair. Speed up the rules, and we don't want rules. But on the other hand, we're hearing from the landfill folks, we need a rule. And I'm actually sympathetic with the landfill folks needing a rule because it seems to me that there is an unintended consequence going on when some folks in western Minnesota, central Sands area, have very porous soil and their drinking water is becoming contaminated. That's not where you want to put a landfill. On the other hand, there are places in Minnesota where it's just chunks and chunks of clay. You could put a landfill there and be fine. Nothing would happen unless a tornado came through. But the way people are citing landfills now is they are choosing a spot and then saying, let's engineer that spot so it works, rather than choosing a spot where it's all clay and nothing's going to happen. So I think that's one of the unintended consequences of not having some bottom line rule for folks to say, you know, we've got to protect the water. I mean, the reason we had the landfill cleanup bill is because people's drinking water is getting contaminated, for gosh sakes. And nobody wants that. So I'm sympathetic, Mr. Chair, but I'm hoping that you guys can do a rule for demolition landfills that actually is saying if you choose a site that is good, these are the rules. But if you choose a site that is problematic, then you're going to have to do more. I mean, am I clear here?
Mr. Kudelka. Mr. Chair and committee members, I know we're going to have more conversations on this because it is an important topic. But I think you have hit on one of the issues here. Additional monitoring data, as mentioned before, has come through the system, and it has cast a different, more knowledge. We are struggling with the rules that are there. There are some very definitive stuff, which says where the topography, geology, and soil is inadequate for protection of groundwater or surface water, a CMD landfill is not allowed. We have other places in monitoring where the commissioner is given the ability to take those things into consideration to create a modeling plan. So in some places there is flexibility, in some places there is not. We agree a rulemaking needs to be done. We have been, since the hearing from the chair last year, have been meeting monthly with a stakeholder group on this to start pull together information and also some common things that we agree with and some things that we disagree with to determine what we need to tackle moving forward. We've already started dedicating some resources internally, pulling from some areas to start pulling data together for rulemaking. And if you look on the docket on the rulemakings to come, there's a generic category for landfills. And our anticipation is to start working on assigning rulemaking and legal needs to do a rulemaking for C&D landfills. However, we're in a sticky situation is we still have permits that folks want and need, in some cases for expansion, where we have new data that we have to incorporate in and knowingly put out to the public and say, these still meet the existing rules, or these situations will protect the environment. How do we balance that with the new information on site specifics? And those are conversations we need to take on a case-by-case to where we know there's more risk, how do we dial back some of the risk, but still allow for an opportunity for citizens to dispose of waste in a clean, proper way. We agree with the chair and others who have stated the idea of just pouring it out in the back in a hole is not the answer either, and it's a delicate balance. This is not an easy situation or rulemaking for the agency, and I think the stakeholders, and we all agree that there is not an easy answer.
Follow-up.
Just a quick follow-up. I know you can project what a rulemaking costs, and would you bring a cost of a rulemaking for demolition landfills with the idea in mind that it might not be a might be different rules for somebody who decides to site over clay versus somebody who's going to site over sand?
Mr. Chair and committee members, that is, we can work on a cost estimate for you, and we do understand there are different types of situations we have to tackle, and I think it's a question of a number of things. How is a landfill designed? How are they maintained and operated, cover, those type of things, daily cover, and what type of materials are going in? There's a lot of things for us to look at to get to your point of managing risk based on the environment that's there and the products going into it.
Follow-up.
If I could follow up, though, I think we are assuming that we are going to engineer any site that people bring forth. We need to give people clues right up front that choose a site, and that's not where our statute reads right now, and that's one of the problems. Choose a site in a place where there's a lot of clay. Don't choose a site that's going to have to be highly engineered in order to work. And we need to help people get that. Because one's going to be cheap and the other's going to be expensive to boot.
Commissioner Kudelka, quickly, please.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I think that is something to consider in the discussions we have with folks and permits on choosing the right location and how you operate to make it easier on yourself and not have those additional costs, which I know neither landfill operators nor us want folks to bear.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for asking where the public meetings were going to be held on the sulfate standard. Just one quick request, since we aren't unable to attend those meetings because of our business down here, if I could get a breakdown of what the public comments have to say. And I'm just going to be interested to see if this will be another one-size-fits-all standard or if it's going to be an industry-specific targeted standard when the rulemaking comes out. Thank you.
Representative Lewick, final person on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, testifiers. We'll obviously be seeing lots of you folks. And this one you probably can't answer in detail until we see the governor's budget proposal, but going back to sometimes we're a worst enemy, we add things to agencies and then wonder why the process slows down, but that increased requirement to define costs, both the negative and positive sides of these rules, I'm very interested in how much time your people, and when I say your people, I'm thinking in terms of highly skilled technical scientific people spend out there doing general economic analysis, because that doesn't seem that that's going on a very good use of your folks' skill set. I don't, you know, personal example, I've got to do 90% of my herd health for my livestock, but the most important 10% is what I get from the veterinarian who's 80 miles away as to the real parameters. So I would just like to explore that. Yeah, you don't even have to answer. Obviously, there's a lot of detail, but do we really leverage what's available outside on a commercial perspective? Because we got a whole commercial world out there that deals with defining costs right down to the point where they'll tell you no in a microsecond and they'll explain in detail why it won't work or why it makes sense. So it's just looking forward to figure out whether we're best use of resources and whether we shouldn't be contracting some of that out to the private sector. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We're going to switch over here now. It's going to take a minute or two to get some of the technology switched around. So if you want to get a cup of coffee or something, help yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Yep. Started. I know. The coffee break just ended.
You know how long we get at work?
Yeah, well, this is a vacation. This isn't work. We got to get some water skiing in here or something.
I'm ready to go.
I know. I am too.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Hey, good morning.
I'll introduce myself and Angie with me. John Jaske, Executive Director of Board of Water and Soil Resources, and Angie Becker-Cadelka, Assistant Director of Board of Water and Soil Resources.
Thank you. Proceed with your presentation.
So just a wee bit of background about myself, and I'll give a little bit more about Angie, too. And you can get more of it when you We come visit with you if you've got an issue.
Let me interrupt, Executive Director. Members, we're going to hold questions till the end, okay? We're going to hold the questions till the end. Okay. And then we need to the page around. Can you turn the volume up, please, on Director Kadelka's microphone?
Just broken, Mr. Chairman, a little bit better? Okay.
A little better, yep.
So just a wee bit of background. You know, I live in St. Paul. I grew up on a dairy farm in central Minnesota. And, you know, I think one of the points I want to make about that is that conservation, clean water, all of those issues are really both urban and rural, as many of our programs cross that same aspects of Minnesota. We have programs and people that work from corner to corner. Ms. Becker-Kadelka also grew up in a rural area of Iowa, smaller town than I even grew up in, but, you know, we both live in the city now, too, and I wanted to make you aware of the fact that we've got a background that covers that gamut. So more details as we get into our programs. Our agency mission is to improve and protect Minnesota's water and soil resources by working in partnership with local organizations and private landowners, and we focus on private lands, and we focus on doing our work through local governments. And this map here will show you the state of Minnesota at large with the landscapes identified in yellow as the private lands. Of course, this is, you know, I think you already know most of this. That's where the focus of our work is. The public land authorities, the Forest Service, the DNR, they're responsible for the public lands. Our agency is small in comparison. We have about 110 staff. We are able to operate that way because we use a much larger local government delivery system consisting of counties, watershed districts, stormwater conservation districts, cities, and even some cases with townships are involved in carrying out this work. And that's really important because when you're working on private land, you know, landowners want to know who they're working with. They want to know someone's local enough to be able to help them when they've got a problem or a question. And those local technical professionals are the way all of our programs get delivered to. We'll cover some more statutes as well as the budgets and the appropriations that make that work possible. This is a very high-level summary. There are statutory authorities. We'll walk through those in a minute just so you can see, you know, where they're derived from. In this case, the Soil and Water Conservation Districts and the Watershed Districts, as well as the WMOs, which are the Watershed Management Organizations in the metropolitan area, these authorities to the agency provide the oversight of these organizations, although most of the work that they do is self-driven. These statutory authorities here to create, establish boundaries, to approve plans, provide funding, evaluate performance, and provide program oversight are in existing statutes and kind of put the boundaries around how these programs operate. We have an agency structure that consists of a board, of 20 members that are appointed by the governor to four-year terms. They represent various parts of the state and various aspects of local government, citizens, and the agencies. The local government representatives include county commissioners, city officials, soil and water conservation districts and watershed districts, as well as a township representative. The current chair of the board acting chair is Jerry Van Amberg from Moorhead, Minnesota. This is the list of statutory authorities that have been in place, some of them for a very long time, some more recent. I'll just walk through these. The Chapter 12A is the natural disaster statute that was created several years ago to provide orderly assessment and assistance when we have natural disasters, which often occur in the case of our agency related to flooding events. Water policy is a large umbrella part of the statute that describes not only what we do, but what other agencies are also responsible for. 103B establishes the authority of the agency primarily, as well as providing the authorities and some details about how they're carried out and the water management of counties, watershed districts, soil and water conservation districts. And then each of those have their own statutes. In this case, 103C for soil and water conservation districts, 103D for watershed districts. 103E is the drainage statute, which is the oldest of all these statutes. It's been around since the late 1800s. And there's some work that we do to facilitate that program. We'll talk about more about that later. 103F includes the buffer protection law as well as other protection statutes. 103G includes the wetland conservation act and also the public waters piece of DNR. Groundwater protection has got a lot of different agencies bearing that responsibility, and the Clean Water Legacy Act is about dealing with the water quality aspects of our agency as well as PCA and others.
So, Mr. Chair and members, yes. Angie Becker-Kadelka, Assistant Director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources.
Proceed.
So to accomplish our mission and to implement these authorities, we look at how do we address state and local resource concerns. So our role with our local government partners is to take all the studies and the plans and the research that you've heard about from other agency overviews and to apply that to real-world implementation. So, for example, the picture on the left-hand side of that slide shows an aerial view of a farm field, and you'll see a bunch of lines in there, the pattern tiling, the subsurface tile that drains the water off the land. It's what makes the land productive. It's what makes the land farmable and brings those economics to the state of Minnesota through that farm economy. Then we look at, so recognizing that and recognizing it's an important part of our economy, how do we take, and as that water's coming off the field, where necessary to store it or to treat that water, to maybe slow it down before it hits a river or a lake. And so on the right is a wetland restoration, and this one happens to be in Rice County, where it's taking time to actually slow down that water and to let sediments and nutrients filter out. We also accomplish our mission by working with local governments to provide targeted planning, delivery implementation, and assessments to prioritize those on-the-ground conservation projects. We also accomplish our mission by working with local governments to ensure compliance of environmental laws, rules, and regulations like the Wetland Conservation Act, like drainage law, and recently buffers. Our budget. So our budget for fiscal year 16-17 biennium is $195 million. Legacy amendment has had a significant impact on our agency's mission and our work. And so you'll see the Clean Water Fund comprises about 58% of Bowser's budget, Outdoor Heritage Fund 16%, and then our general fund appropriation is about 19% of our budget, and then some funds with LCCMR, bonding, and then some federal funds as well. Of that, most of the money that is appropriated to the Board of Water and Soil Resources is used locally. So we average between 86 and 90% of our budget goes out locally to local governments for delivery of conservation implementation. And then 10% is for agency program development and operations.
Okay, and I'm going to get back into the program areas now with some more detail. The first of those is the resource protection rules and laws. The Wetland Conservation Act, the drainage law, and the buffer program, we talked about that already, as well as the excessive soil loss. Some of these have rules, some of them do not, but they operate in a very similar fashion, again, all through local governments. Wetland Conservation Act is a statutory authority that prescribes a no-net loss idea that wetlands are important to protect for water quality, habitat, and other public benefits, and that not all wetland impacts are avoidable, and so when they are unavoidable, road projects are one of the prime examples of that, as well as other development type endeavors. A mitigation option is provided where a wetland can be replaced someplace else if it can't be avoided. That program has been in place now since 1991, and again, it's carried out by local governments with a shared piece of work between the state and federal governments as well to make sure we get landowners as best we can the same answer, you know, in a prompt fashion. One of the things that's been working very well since that law was created was something called a technical evaluation panel, where a local agent and a state agent, and sometimes they invite the federal people in as well to make a decision and get the landowner the best information they can in one setting. On the ground typically is where that works best, as well as through permitting that's been coordinated to some extent already. And we'll talk more about that, and I'm sure an upcoming opportunity with your committee here in the 404 assumption study. I will also spend a little bit of time updating the committee on the road replacement piece at the end of this presentation, so we'll defer that one for the time being. Drainage, again, I mentioned this law has been around since the late 1800s. It was commissioned to remove water from the land so it could be used for production purposes. And so in Minnesota, we have a what we call a public drainage system. It's really built and paid for by private interests, private landowners, but it's managed by a public trustee, in this case, a county board or a joint board or a watershed district board. So it's a little different than other states where you have more private sector trusts that are set up to do those things. We have private drainage in Minnesota as well. Some of it is connected to these public systems. Some of it is not. In statute, there is a provision for Bowser to facilitate this drainage work group, and I've been doing that for the better part of 10 years now, where we bring together all of the various interests in that topic, from the local governments to the landowners and ag community to the urban and environmental groups as well, and talk about how to make that statute and that infrastructure managed well enough so that it can provide the benefits of providing production as well as not causing harm to water quality and other important public interests downstream. Buffers, we'll have another opportunity to talk about that more on Thursday, so we're going to go through this very quickly. We'll come back with much more detail about that at the joint hearing Thursday morning. Obviously, there's various settings where this practice, which is what a buffer is, a conservation practice, and water quality, it really is its primary purpose. We have lots of places where this has been done already in Minnesota and a few more to do. And there's various configurations of how this practice works in various settings along lakes, rivers, streams, wetlands, ditches. Some places you can see we've got them, and that's what we're looking to get more of. The very, very preliminary inventory that we've done, you know, shows that, you know, at least 80% of the areas that would need a buffer already have one. So that's a good starting point. Here's an example of a ditch buffer in the upper right. And a wider buffer in the lower right. The ditch buffers, we'll talk more about that too on Thursday, but those are the ditch authority has the responsibility in some cases, or at least has the option to put those buffers in on behalf of the entire system, whereas the public water buffers are the responsibility of the landowner. And here's just an example of that inventory that we've started, not we, Bowser, but the local governments who are responsible for working with landowners. The soil and water conservation districts across the state have been doing an off-site method of looking at the status of where the buffers are already in or where they may still need to be. This is an example just showing that on a parcel basis, the blue areas are where they've identified certainty with compliance, and the red areas are where they either need to look a little bit more carefully or they've determined that it's not compliant. Now, again, these are all being done with remote methods, and they will be following up on that with, you know, on-site work to make sure that what they're inventorying is accurate. Excessive soil loss, there is a provision in statute to address this via a complaint-based mechanism. It's not very often used, but there are a few places once in a while where some problem needs to be solved that's causing harm to others, and this is an example of that. I'm not going to show any more pictures of these problems because there's plenty of those, and there's many more of things that we can do to correct it or remedy it.
So our land and water management programs, delivering those projects and practices through local governments, they're designed to address problems, and so problems happen both on the urban and rural landscape, as we all know. The picture on the upper left is an area where there's a sediment problem on this farm field. The picture on the lower right is, this one happens to be a St. Cloud parking lot where there are direct pipes that are going out to the Mississippi, so there is a runoff problem. Some solutions then. So land and water solutions might be something like a grass waterway, and that would be something that we with our local government partners would work with a landowner to implement on their land, or down below these urban practices like a stormwater retrofit or a rain garden to slow down or filter out water before it hits the pipes or the river. The way we do our work is through voluntary conservation. And so we look at it as a conservation continuum, where on the left-hand side, a landowner might choose to implement conservation with no land or with no support. Maybe there's just technical assistance. Maybe it's doing something on their own. Towards the middle of the continuum, there might be a contract or a project that a landowner would get assistance to build. to short-term land retirement. So something like CRP, where there's 15 years, a landowner might choose to retire their land under a short-term contract, all the way to a perpetual land easement, so long-term retirement. The idea behind this is it's all based on landowner choice, so what works best for the land and for that landowner. One of our programs is really taking now is taking a look at watershed governance and accountability. Back in 2011, the Local Government Roundtable, which included folks from the Association of Minnesota Counties, the Association of Soil and Water Districts, and the Association of Watershed Districts, got together to take a look at the boundaries by which we manage water. So traditionally, we manage water on political boundaries, you know, county lines. And so how do we recognize that water flows beyond those political boundaries? And so as a result of their work, legislation was passed then in 2012 that authorized Bowser to start working on how do we develop models around watershed governance and accountability. The One Watershed, One Plan program has pilot projects that are just now being finished. And these pilot projects are showing that as these local governments are getting together and designing their plans, that they're coming up with prioritized, targeted, and measurable actions that focus in on what's it going to take, what's the result we're going to see, and how much will it cost to get us there. We also have Clean Water Fund dollars where we allocate through a competitive process projects and practices to local governments. You'll see this map shows that it's throughout the state. And an example on the right, this one I believe is in Benton County on Little Rock Lake, that a specific project in and of itself may not solve the problem. But we have the tools and technology now to say this is the progress towards a goal. So this set of projects, for example, that was awarded to the local governments in Benton County, I think it was $163,000, we're going to get them 11% towards their phosphorus reduction goal. Another example in Wadena County, this one is groundwater. And so this one happened to be on irrigation, and the idea was providing cost share incentives to landowners to change from high pressure to low pressure irrigation systems. And the idea was how can we reduce groundwater draw as well as reduce nitrates. We also have voluntary resource protection programs. This is our RIM reserve, our easement program that has been around now for just over 30 years. The idea around perpetual easements targeted to the most critical areas to protect and manage resources. These projects have multiple benefits for habitat and for water quality, and what they all have in common is that they all involve landowners. A few projects also involve other partners outside of local governments and landowners. They might be nonprofit groups like Pheasants Forever or Ducks Unlimited or local lake association that helps with these projects. Those of you who were around yesterday for the signing, yesterday was a big day for conservation in Minnesota. The governor entered into an agreement with the United States Department of Agriculture to sign a CREP, a Minnesota CREP, which is a $500 million project, of which $350 million of that is federal dollars. Federal dollars coming in to Minnesota for direct payments to landowner to do conservation. The CREP will be in a 54-county area focused in on three practices. It's going to be creating buffers, restoring wetlands, and then protecting wellhead areas for drinking water. It's up to 60,000 acres, and then this is targeted to the most environmentally sensitive areas. So we're going to really take a look at, as these applications come in, what are the most environmentally sensitive areas for this program. And here's the reason why. So CRP, that 15-year federal program, and that has had strong, you know, we have strong bipartisan support, I think, as a state for this type of conservation in Minnesota. And we're lucky to have that. CRP, we have approximately 600,000 acres that are going to expire from those 15-year contracts over the next 5 years. Recent averages say about half of those get re-enrolled. And so even with this CREP, even with the 60,000 acres, we're still projecting a net loss of over 200,000 acres of conservation in Minnesota. And so that's what makes it even more important to target those 60,000 acres to the most environmentally sensitive and critical land that will get us the best benefit on that public investment. As a total side note, the U.S. Department of Agriculture said in their conversations with us and why that they were giving Minnesota this reward is that they said that the proactive work by legislation that appropriated over $50 million of that $150 million commitment, state commitment, that legislatures had done was something that they don't often see, and it was something that they felt showed that Minnesota was ready and really wanting to do this kind of work. Very quickly, our administration and agency operations. This includes our board operations. As John said, we are governed by a board that is appointed by the governor. We also provide training. So in order to do this work, providing training with our local government partners on how to design those grass waterways and how to implement these programs, how to do that kind of project management. And last but not least, unfortunately, not all conservation can be planned and not all of it is predictable. And so we also recognize that the disasters that happen across the state and disasters that are happening frequently require immediate attention, and we have statutory authority to help provide some of those immediate kinds of gathering of data and being able to then provide support locally to get some of these things fixed. We like to think that those 100-year disasters only happen every 100 years, but Bowser has been appropriated flood disaster monies for floods in 2007, 2008, 2009, 10, 12, 14, and 16, which gives us all that sober pause of how often floods are happening throughout the state. And so our disaster recovery program is working in partnership with our local government partners, again, to figure out where these disasters are impacting land, maybe their conservation practices, maybe their new areas that need help and support and fixing those. This is also our 30-year anniversary. So Bowser has been around now in 2017 for 30 years. Over that time, there's been over 15,000 practices installed. Number of grants, you see there, over 120,000 tons of sediment annually kept out of Minnesota's waterways. And over 6,500 easements for a little over a quarter million acres of wetlands and grasslands. With that, we will pause now for questions, and then we have a short local roads presentation as well.
I would prefer to just go right to the wetland replacement stuff, and then we will come back, and I even have some questions.
Okay. Thank you, sir, members. Just a short update on this program. This was a statutory provision passed into law in 1996, which directed or required the state, Bowser specifically, on behalf of local road authorities, the counties, the cities, and townships, to mitigate the wetlands that are lost because of a road project improvement, mostly for safety reasons. This statute has been in place since then, non-controversial. The issue, of course, is that it takes money to build these things, and the reason this piece of statute has been supported broadly is because we get a better ecological outcome by mitigating the wetlands someplace other than in a road right-of-way typically, and we also get a much more cost-effective outcome because we can do it on a larger scale instead of in a whole bunch of smaller places. And so this is what you see on the left there is when the road authority has to upgrade that road. You know, there's a wetland in the way sometimes, especially in parts of the state where there's quite a few wetlands. And so they will, you know, build the road to the specifications that the safety engineers prescribe. They will measure the amount of wetland that's impacted by that, and they will report it to the state, and we will do the mitigation on their behalf, and that has provided the road authorities with a more streamlined permitting process, more predictability in the getting their projects approved by both state and federal governments. And then they, as road authorities and engineers that build roads, don't have to worry about trying to build a wetland. That's not the thing that they're set up to do. And so on the right, you see an example. We go build one of these things. So if you get, you know, 20 acres of impacts in, you know, 20 different little areas, you go build a 20-acre wetland someplace else that's going to be much more effective in terms of functionality and being able to sustain it there. So that's the idea. It's very practical and cost-effective. The challenge, of course, is that you have to have funding to do it, and the legislature has appropriated funding over the years, always from bonding dollars, because you're building a permanent piece of infrastructure that the state puts a conservation easement on, and then therefore we use the bonding funds to do that. But over the years, there's been a shortfall as we simply ask for what amount is needed based on the projections of road authority impacts over the previous years, and then that's the number that we seek. And of course, the way things go, we don't often get what we seek. And so we are at a point where we no longer have credits available and or dollars in the queue to build more of these sites to accomplish this requirement. And so what the statute prescribes is that we have to then let local government road authorities know that these credits are no longer available, and they have to go back and find another way to accomplish that, which unfortunately, of course, means that they hadn't planned it that way, and it may have some consequences to the schedule that they're on to get their road projects built, because they need to have the permits to do that. So you can see here in these three bank service areas, as we call them, these areas across the state that are watershed boundaries, more or less, that we have to, in this case, close those areas because the credits are no longer available. We also, you can see in bank service area two, we are currently at zero, but we have some that we believe are coming online. So we're trying to do this projection of what's coming online from past work, looking at the needs that the local road authorities are telling us are there based on their reports. And we don't close it until we have to, but in these three cases, we have to. Now, you know, you may ask, well, what is the consequence? And you may hear from the road authorities about what that is. I think some of them are likely to experience a delay in some of their projects getting built, or maybe at least pre-designed and ready for a bid. We also, the remedy, of course, is that, you know, we get the funding track back in place. The governor has a $10 million recommendation in the bonding bill that he talked about a couple of weeks ago. That would be very helpful. If we are able to get the money back in place, we can then work on agreements with the federal government, the Army Corps of Engineers, and our own authorities under law to get this back the way it was intended, where all the road authorities can take advantage of it. Even if we've got a zero balance, if we've got a commitment with money committed to it, we can do something called an in-lieu agreement where it allows them to proceed with a negative balance because we have credits coming online. So short story to fix this is to have the money come and follow the policy they currently have. With that, Mr. Chairman, we are done with our presentation.
Thank you, Commissioner. Director, excuse me. Just one real quick question back on your on your CREP conversation. Talked about the $350 million from the feds and $150 from the state. Give me the timeline where that is going to be. How is that going to be distributed over how many years?
Sure. Mr. Chair and members, the CREP agreement is designed to be a five-year program, so it'll be obtaining and restoring and implementing this project over 5 years, of which the funding is really needed up front. So the funding is needed now, because in order for us to move forward and accept a project, we have to have the money in hand to obligate it. And so then to obligate it, we move forward and we do the easement processing, we clear the title, we record the easement, then the landowner will get their payment, and then the land will be restored. So while the whole process for one person, one farmer, might be over a year, and some of the payments might take into that account, the money is really needed early on in the kind of the front end of that so that we can obligate that and start moving ahead.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome.
A couple of questions. On the CREP, you're thinking you're going to be able to deal with 60,000 acres, and you have put wellhead protection for drinking water as one of the things you're going to spend money on, mm-hmm. which is good. But I have questions about how many acres of wellhead protection do you think you're going to get, I mean, with this money?
Mm-hmm. Ms. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair, members, so this is all as part of the voluntary piece in, and so, of course, this is all dependent on people's interest in each of those specific practices. And what we've heard and what we've seen is that there's a high demand for landowners for buffers and for wetland protection. The well had some, and so we figure that there should be a certain portion set aside to really go after those wellhead protection areas in those municipal areas that the Department of Health has said are vulnerable and highly vulnerable, and that those are the ones we should go take a look at first and focus on to see if we can find areas that would really make a big difference in that draw on those wells. So those are the ones we're really going to focus on.
Director Kozelka, I'll come back to you.
I think there's also the other factor that plays into that is how much state money has been appropriated for that specific purpose. And so we can get you a summary, but the number I'm recalling is that we have currently in hand of the $150 million that is needed, $54.8 million. And that's from a variety of sources, Clean Water Fund, Ultra Heritage Fund, LCCMR. Some of that is designated specifically for wellhead protection, and so we have to line up the state funding with its conditions with the federal money that's available. But as Ms. Becker-Kadelka said, we will be targeting the places that have those vulnerabilities.
Representative Lagunas.
Okay. The reason I asked about this is these are protect drinking water wells mainly in outstate Minnesota, and the issue here is that there's 350,000 acres that need to be protected, and we've only protected a couple thousand. So if I were in an area where my well was getting, my municipal well was getting polluted, if we don't have a wellhead protection area, then those people who live in that community are going to have to upgrade their drinking water plant. And so to say, it feels like we're not doing enough for municipalities because they're going to get stuck with a bigger bill if we can't do. I mean, you look at what's happening in Hastings. They're getting ready to need to spend like $8 million more to upgrade their drinking water plant because their wellhead protection area isn't working. So I'm concerned about that. Is this, when you do the wellhead protection crap, is that permanent or temporary?
It is permanent, perpetual. Yep.
Okay. That's it. Okay. Then, if I
follow up.
Yes. For the St. Cloud parking lot, I mean, it's a good thing you're doing what you're doing. Did St. Cloud do that a long time ago? I mean, did the university do that a long time ago, or is that a recent parking lot?
Mr. Chairman, that parking lot's been there a long time. So it was a retrofit project, and of course, you know, St. Cloud State University is right on the river bluff on the west side there, and so they found a way to retro design the stormwater treatment into the existing parking lot, is the way I understand that project was carried out.
Representative Lagunas.
Okay, and the last thing is,
promise.
Come back talking about buffers. Would you have a list of counties where the buffers are almost complete, or, you know, the percentage completion by counties, so we can see which ones are almost finished and which ones need a lot of work?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we will have some preliminary data. It will have to be field verified because no one needs to have a decision that's final until it's actually exactly precise on their property. But we'll have some preliminary information for you Thursday.
Thank you. Representative Wodzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a general question, kind of. I think Representative Wodzinski kind of asked the question just from a permanent standpoint. Will there be any non-permanent options for ag owners when it comes to this? Obviously, the push is to tie this land up forever, but, you know, some folks appreciate having non-permanent options to look at when it comes to any of these things. Are you guys pursuing any of those?
Director Jaski?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, so as Ms. Becker-Kadelka pointed out, you know, this conservation continuum exists, and it's not only state funding that is part of that, but it's also a great deal of federal funding and local funding as well. And so in that suite of options, from just getting some helpful advice to a permanent conservation easement and something in between, we have the existing conservation reserve program that the federal government has, and we use that. We also use something called the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, ECQIP. The federal government has lots of acronyms, so if we say one of them out loud and you don't know what it is, just let us know. But we also have the Conservation Stewardship Program, CSP. There's a bunch of other options the federal government has. We also have a state cost share program, which is somewhere in the neighborhood, typically 10-year agreements that allow for landowners to get a soil and water conservation district agreement that allows them to put in a buffer strip or other practices that the state would help pay for.
Representative Spodzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of, you know, you talked about the $90 million. Is there a timeline so if the state fails to act on those dollars would disappear? Or,
Mr. Chair. Okay. Members, so the federal $350 million is predicated on the fact that the state could come up with that full match, and so it kind of works in tandem. So that's it's basically a 70-30 split, and so as the state comes up with money, then that federal money has been set aside, but it is released as, to be moved forward as obligating those to landowner payments.
Representative, okay, thank you. Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to first, I know DNR and folks are up there, I was looking at some of the rafts that was put along a shoreline and had a small little project in my district that we were trying to work on for many years that our previous chair worked on. I'd be remiss because it happened at the end of session if I didn't thank the committee for that opportunity last year to get that done. Saved a little business in my district and people partnered up and made it work. So I appreciate that. And Representative Spodzinski, you just answered or asked my last question. That answered, so.
Thank you. It's a lot shorter than last night. Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you talked about the one watershed, one plan area. I'd like to call attention to page 14. Lake and Cook counties just recently won an award for their work on the Superior watershed. But if you take a look at the line going north and east of there, that's where you get into the Rainy River watershed. So my question is, on these one watershed, one plan issues, you made the comment that water knows no boundary. So what kind of implementation or what kind of contact do you have with Canada, province of Ontario, as far as the Rainy River Watershed District specifically, because that goes from east of Lake and Cook County, where that line is, up through Lake of the Woods and onto the Hudson Bay. And there's a lot of projects on the Canadian side that we would never see on this side. And so what kind of information do you get from Canada when you're developing these watershed plans?
Director Kadelka.
I think I can take that one, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
So, obviously, you know, our state statutes and our state funding, you know, don't cross the border, and they have the same provisions, right, unless there's a treaty in place. There are several border organizations, though, that are working, and I know there's one that deals specifically with Lake of the Woods, and there's also one that deals with the Red River in its entirety, and the northwestern Minnesota, the Red River Basin Commission. In fact, they're having their annual conference today through Thursday up in Fargo, and that's it's a nonprofit organization, but they have governance through the states and local governments in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the province, and so they can get a lot of coordination done across those borders, even if you can't transfer authorities or money across those borders. So it'd be a cooperative approach is what it would take because, of course, state authorities don't cross that boundary.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess the reason I ask that, if you go along the Rainy River, which Minnesota side has done a very good job on their farming practices and stuff like that, but you take a look at the other side and a lot of their farming practices aren't up to what the standards we are. So a lot of our industries and agriculture included is facing a tough standard that the others don't. So, I mean, I realize that the border is the border, but if we're going to get the right practices in place, we need to figure out how to bring the other people that are involved in these watersheds into play on it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
To that point, Representative Eklund, we have the same thing going on in the Red River. And before I forget, is there anybody else here who has any comments on what we're doing today that they would like to be up front? Very good. Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Jashke, my memory serves me right. When we've had the Reinvest in Minnesota programs before, whether they were CREP or WRP, there's always been this push and pull about permanent versus temporary easements, but and that usually takes place here or in the paper or in, on the airwaves. But when actual people have the opportunity to sign up, you have a waiting list. Could you provide evidence of your last permanent easement programs and how many people were left on the table because there wasn't enough money, or what the sign-up was where people couldn't get in because we didn't have enough money, where actual people signed up for the programs? Because I think that's maybe if you just can answer if that was correct and if you could provide that data, I think it would be helpful.
Director Kudelka.
Mr. Chair, members, it's a good question. So in the last sign-up that we did as part of RIM Reserve, we had a $9 million appropriation, and this is just all I can get the actual numbers. We actually stopped the sign-up 3 weeks in because we had gotten over $23 million in applications, and so we knew that we weren't going to be able to adequately provide for all of the applications. So I know that we had stopped the sign-up at that point and said that we would address that $23 million. And I think the piece that goes with that is we recognize that doing the perpetual protection doesn't take away from anything else. And so we look at what are all of the options and that it's completely landowner choice. So voluntary permanent protection is just additive to all of the others that we think are necessary and important.
Follow up. Representative Brian Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I just have a couple of quick questions here. I apologize if this is asked. The first one was asked before I had to step out for a minute. Dealing with the road wetland replacement. In my area, I've had a couple town boards not even participate in that program just because of the nightmare of the paperwork. I don't know what the paperwork is. They just don't even want to even try anymore because they tried to do it in the past, and it was a very major headache for the town board members to complete. So what they'd end up doing is they'd rebuild the road, and one of them happened, the wetland was at the intersection. They stopped short of that of the wetlands, so they went from a 24-foot wide road to a 20-foot wide road at the intersection and didn't touch the intersection. So I was just wondering if you could look at the process and see if you can make it easier for these townships to do the paperwork so we can get this done right to make the road safer. Mm-hmm. And the other issue that I have is in the fact, I got an email on this 3 weeks ago. We have a lot of good conservation programs for our land. But what I'm wondering is how many do we have out there between the state and federal government that on our property tax don't give some relief on the property tax for taking that land out of production? I know some of them provide some property tax relief and others don't. And when they sign up for these programs, getting an income off this land, and now they take it out of production, put it in the conservation, but they still have that same high property tax on it. So I was wondering if we could get a list of which ones are between both state and federal, which ones have some property tax relief and which ones don't, so we can get that out to our constituents.
Director Jaski.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think on your second point, we'll get you a list. Obviously, you know, some of the programs are shorter and longer and different conditions, and obviously assessors have to factor all those things in, so we'll see if we come up with a list. On your first point, what I would suggest to your township officials that are confused about that is the very reason that law was put in place was to avoid what you're describing. So one of the best resources, though, for a township official on any road project, whether it's for the environmental issues or permits or anything else, is to call a county engineer and say, hey, Mr. Engineer, Ms. Engineer, can you help me understand what to do here? And they'll 99% of the time be able to help them. But if they aren't, then, of course, let us know and we can try and help them too.
Okay, members, just a reminder, tomorrow we have the buffer update, and we will be meeting over in the Capitol in room 120. Okay? Anything else? We're adjourned.